Warning: the following podcast will contain spoilers for Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, which we will be discussing in depth today, as well as The Passage and The 12 by Justin Cronin and The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Sorry. Is that delicious? Whoever's having that?
Oh, yeah. It's just chai.
Well, it sounds delicious.
That is like the perfect sipping sound.
I guess my mic is working perfectly then. Hello everyone, welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is going to be the third meeting of the VOK Book Club. Today we'll be discussing Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and we are all recording from our hermetically sealed safe rooms, so we cannot be infected by the Georgian flu, or Ebola, or anything else that will try to kill us during the course of this podcast. My name's Greg, I'm Claudius the Fool on the forums, and we're joined by five other vassals today. Do you guys want to introduce yourself?
I'm Alex, known as Lucky Charms on the forums.
Hi, this is Amber, Amber Rocks on the forums.
Hi, this is Michal. Ink as ran in the forums.
And this is Zach, also known as Alias in the forums.
And this is Alex's first VOK, so make sure we be extra nice to him.
Don't
jump on him. I'm a very sensitive soul.
All right, so just to start off, I'll do a very brief overview of the book. Of course, it will be spoiler-filled. Basically, the book is just came out a couple months ago. It's published by Knopf in the U.S. and Canada, and it has been hailed as the post-apocalyptic book, but for literary readers also. It has been shortlisted for the National Book Award, which if it wins, all the literary world will definitely freak out and say how awful it is, as some of them have been saying already. But the book is basically divided into, I guess, three parts. It's set in the current day where this disease called the Georgian flu is about to hit and kill 99.9% of people. And then it's set 20 years later. And then it's also set in the, it follows this one character in his life before the Georgian flu. Because the book actually starts with this, famous actor dropping dead on stage during a performance of King Lear. And he's kind of the thread that ties all the other point of view characters together. It's been called a hopeful post-apocalyptic book, which I don't really know how hopeful it is, but it's a really great book. I've read a ton of post-apocalyptic fiction, and this really struck a chord with me more than, probably almost as much as The Road, which is one of the most, visceral books I've ever read. It's just post-apocalyptic at the center of it, but there's a lot of other stuff going on, which I feel like I've said this exact same thing before in a book club that we've discussed.
Postman.
Yeah, The Postman. Of course.
Yes.
That's what you need to say. Postman.
How did I forget that? If nothing else, I'm getting people to say those words more often, so eventually the movie will be watched. But what did you guys think, just a general, what you thought about it and your appropriate lemon cake rating?
I guess I'd give it a 4 knife tattoos out of 5.
There we go.
Good choice.
I think structurally and formally, this book is fantastic. The only real criticism I have is I don't think any of the dialogue was particularly memorable, but I think Mandel is great at capturing sort of the awkward passive aggressiveness of human interaction. And this isn't on the text at all, but it's just me. But I've been reading a lot of historical accounts of the Armenian genocides and the Japanese occupation of Korea. So I'm sort of been emotionally exhausted this past month, and I didn't quite get into this book as well as I would have liked to. But it's a 4 out of 5.
We're doing lemon cakes, right?
Or you can do knife tattoos. I like that. I didn't think of anything ahead of time, of course.
Okay, that was the part
I personally have only killed 2 people, and I don't want to give it 2, so I do this.
I gave it 4.5 knife tattoos. Four knife tattoos and a handle.
Four knives and a dirk. Well,
I killed a little kid. Shorty. That's terrible. I can't believe I said that. I'm so sorry.
He probably died of the flu. Don't worry.
Probably. I don't believe that I've ever read anything in the post-apocalyptic. I mean, the closest I probably come is just watching The Walking Dead every week. But I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed how the little time jumping it did. I also have not read any of the books that use that little technique. I would reread it probably in a couple years. It was pretty quick and easy.
Well, you'll be getting a text file of the top 10 post-apocalyptic books you should have read by now from me.
There are many.
So I guess no one's going to hate the book. That's where it's all going to be enjoying it, but that's all right. Three to go.
It's a good book. I mean, what can you do?
Right.
Let's not have controversy for controversy's sake if it's something
exactly
good.
Mikhail, your thoughts?
Well, I'd give it 1 knife tattoo. No, I'm joking.
Oh, shit.
No, I think this is probably, I mean, I go back and forth, but it's between a 3.5 and a 5 stabbed lemon cakes or whatever. You know, I think it's a really solid book. And I think in retrospect, it's very, very immersive while you're reading it. And it's very absorbing, and it gives you a lot to think about. I think it's maybe a little bit thinner on reflection than I thought it was while I was reading it. But that could also just be, you know, me being like, okay, now I have to talk about this, and thinking, you know, like somebody who like read it and appreciated it and then moved on.
Right.
Might not have the same opinion. But I think it's a good book, and I definitely, I had similar like visceral feelings as when I read The Road, but I didn't want to die like when I read The Road.
Yeah, so. It wasn't that bad. For me, I did really enjoy this book. I'd give it 4.5 bloody lemon cakes, knife tattoos, what have you. I just felt like it was a really, for one, it was very well written, but it was also, like you say, Michal, just a very engaging, I don't know, look at these various perspectives, and I enjoyed that process of kind of putting the puzzle pieces together from all sides. There were points where I felt like it was, where some of the pieces didn't really fit for me. I thought it was kind of ham-fisted and not as comfortable as I liked, but I did enjoy most of those. That point about it being thin is, I think, good. It's just weird for me because I feel like that's very intentional on the part of the author here, because it does feel like there's not a lot of time wasted on, I don't know, just being very overwrought or being very dramatic. It feels like everything is like moving at a pretty fast timber. And to some degree, that's kind of jarring. And it took me a while to get comfortable with that. But I also really enjoyed that, especially because of how consistent it was throughout. Also with the narration style, same thing, kind of weird, but I liked how consistent it was throughout. So it was good for me.
Yeah, I'll give it a 4 point, somewhere between 4.5, 4.75 knife tattoos. I mean, I read a ton of post-apocalyptic fiction, and it's always tough to find something new to get excited about. And this, I think it did that. The only thing I didn't not like it, it just took some getting used to was the format, the time jumps a little bit, where there were sections that I was so looking forward to getting back to, and then I'd flip ahead and be like, I'm not going to get that for another 80 pages. And of course, after 5 pages of reading the new section, I'm engrossed again. But I didn't particularly care about Arthur until we got to that last section where it was really from his point of view. Yeah, I really loved it. I got used to the format, and once it clicked, it really stuck with me. But just the breakdown, the scenes that were set while everything was falling apart, I thought were the most powerful. And I really liked Kirsten as a character, even though I kept calling her Kristen. I just can't say Kirsten. And Jeevan, I was so happy that Jeevan survived, where I wasn't sure for a while if he did or not. Yeah, so I don't mind the fact that we all loved it. Just to start off, Tez, I know you guys, I've read a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction. Amber, you said you haven't. Did this book remind anybody of anything else that it was kind of, you know, echoed with? Or did you really think it kind of stood on its own?
I mean, it definitely reminded me of The Road in terms of travel. And I mean, I think it's actively courting that comparison. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of the post-apocalyptic stuff I read is like actual, like post-apocalyptic, like by the time we're in a dystopia, you know, like I read a lot of young adult fiction, and that's usually, you know, where that is. But in terms of like that feeling that you get when you're reading a real like apocalyptic novel, when everything is ending and it's the world is crashing and burning or falling silent or whatever. Actually, you know what it reminded me a little bit of? This young adult series called Gone by Michael Grant, where it's not an apocalyptic thing, but it's these kids basically in this California town, normal town, whatever. And then suddenly one day all of the adults or everyone over 15 disappears, and there's like this sphere around the town, and just like the idea of like the food running out and like the resources running out and like siphoning gas and like slowly things getting less and less civilized, even though you still have those structures around you. It actually reminded me quite a bit of that.
I mean, The Stand is one of like the benchmarks of post-apocalyptic fiction, and in that book it is a flu that basically kills 99% of the population, and there were parts of this like I kept expecting there to be a point where they were going through a tunnel, because like every post-apocalyptic book has like people traveling through the Midtown Tunnel or something, but they were out of New York by that point. But there were some pretty harrowing scenes of you know, Jeevan getting out of Toronto and just the breakdown at the airport. But It, you know, The Stand, it definitely reminded me of that. And they actually mentioned The Passage by Justin Cronin as one of the characters in the book is reading it. Yeah. And that's one of my favorite books. It's in that they're like vampire zombie kind of things, but it's not a flu, but it's the same thing where there's this big jump and then you get like society 100 years after everything falls apart, which I thought was a nice little throw out.
You know, there's obviously a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction that this could be related to in terms of thematic sort of things it's going for. But I think the framing device is relatively unique, the flu and the idea of looking at people before and after and sort of in the process. Actually, the best example I can think of for comparison is that that network TV show Revolution, if you guys remember that. It's nothing. That show doesn't compare to this at all in terms of quality, but as for the framing device, it is very similar in terms of showing a sort of way after this world that is going back to a very archaic, you know, technological existence, and then also flashbacks seeing how things got to be that way for the various characters. I think that that's pretty consistent in terms of how it works.
And then, of course, Pocahontas post-apocalyptic.
I started
aspect
writing just PA.
It.
We can just say PA from now on.
Postman. That's a long word.
Postmanian.
But also the device, I don't know if it's been used terribly often, but the whole jumping back and forth and you've got these different threads that are coming together and then there's a certain point where you kind of see, oh, that's how this person is connected to this, you know, with Cloud Atlas, which I did not read but saw the movie, you know, that kind of thing. It did remind me of that.
You know, Cloud Atlas, The Stand, The Road, and what's the one mentioned in the book?
The Passage.
The Passage. These are all listed as like recommended reading at the end for the My versions. So we're pretty on point here.
Yeah, the time jumping, it kind of reminds, I don't know if anyone else has read Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, but that book is, you know, you're led to believe that the character is actually jumping around in time. He's doing it in his mind. He's not actually doing it, but that took some getting used to. And the first time I read that, I really didn't like the book, but the second time I loved it, and now it's one of my favorite books. But this kind of reminded me of that, and it did take some getting used to, like that did. I wanted answers, and she held, dangled stuff in front of you and then brought it together at the very end, where it was worth the ride to get there.
I almost feel like it would have been interesting to have the narrative be more present in this story, as it kind of is in Vonnegut in that story. I think that there are moments where it kind of intrudes that I'd liked. They were kind of hard to get used to, but I feel like maybe there was more room for some kind of force that is existing outside the narrative itself.
No, we can talk about that, because I tend to not like books like that where the narrator is overly omnipotent, where the first time it hit you in this book is where, you know, they're having the drinks after Arthur dies.
They say everyone dies, yeah.
And they say, you know, of the three of them, the bartender lasted the longest. He'd be dead in 3 weeks. Yeah. And I don't like that, because I like to find that stuff out on my own. And Stephen King does that too, and I love Stephen King, but sometimes, you know, 80 years later when he was dying peacefully in his bed, you know, like stuff like that.
Spoiler. Yeah,
it's a tricky thing, because I agree with you that it can be a bit jarring, but I think that, again, the way that it's consistently done throughout kind of justifies it for me. And I don't know, I just feel like the story is less about learning what happens to the characters in that way and kind of, I don't know, kind of piecing together the greater whole. Because, like, a lot of it is a given, I guess, given the context that we, I don't know, it's kind of weird. Like, we know that everyone's going to die, so I don't feel bad about having that insight.
Well, I mean, I guess the only characters that it was a question was Jeevan and
Miranda.
Miranda.
Oh, and, Miranda.
Yeah, Miranda was probably the most painful part of the book.
Well, you knew they couldn't all make it. You knew someone was going to have to go.
Yeah, right, and then I guess, like, who was going to die in the immediate present, you know? Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know from a stylistic perspective, like, if it's, like, correct or, you know, if it should have been more consistent, less consistent, but, like, I enjoyed it, and I kind of like that kind of omniscient narrator, and it definitely is like a glass of cold water down your back every time it comes in, so.
And that first time it just hit you, because up till that point it was, you know, we don't know anything about that, really.
On the issue of Shakespeare, it's something like the the chorus at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, where it's clearly spelled out, these characters are going to die horribly. And I think it sort of enhances the existential nature of the text, and it makes it much more comfortable for the reader. So I think functionally it works well.
Yeah, I actually thought that the little mini spoilers were kind of an interesting little quick detour into lives of people that, I mean, obviously, of course, Miranda is a more major character, but, you know, the bartender and whoever is at the leaves the airport or whatever, it's kind of interesting to get a little bit of closure. You know, we're never going to see that bartender again. So, you know, at least we know what happened to him.
Those are both really good points. I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you. You've brought me around on it.
I mean, I guess when you set up that kind of like blanket inescapable doom, basically, except for the people who happen to escape, there is always that question, you know, like she talks later about the two other sisters in the play, you know, like one died in the morning, one in late afternoon. And like, I mean, for these purposes, I think it does kind of like reiterate her point, especially because we are like as much as like the horrible death and destruction is like obviously extremely evident and palpable in when the flu hits, you're still kind of seeing the like day to day, like, oh, there's people, you know, in the present day. So it's possible to forget it a little bit.
Yeah, it's also that it makes them not statistics, not just a number, even if it's just a role. And knowing that this person lived and then they died, you know, it's knowing that 5 billion people probably died as a result of this. But when you know it's a person.
More than that, it had to be.
Yeah, I never, was there like 7 billion people on the planet now? I might be off by 2 billion. I honestly don't know. Is it, it's 7 billion, right?
I think 7.1
billion. 7.1, all right. So yeah, so it's probably like 6.5 billion probably, or even more.
Well, the prophet claims 99.99% of humanity died, but...
Well, we also, there was like the brief mention of early reports being that would be the mortality rate before things went dark, I think.
But
I remember that.
As we found out from Clark's chapter, it really just depends on circumstances though, because if one of those people on his plane had the flu, then they all would have died. But the fact that it seemed like almost a miracle that many people ended up at the airport that weren't infected by it. In a lot of books that deal with disease killing people, it seems like there's a group of people that are just immune to it. And in this, I don't think we're led to believe that. It's basically, if you get it, you're gonna die.
Well, no, because we have that person, I think it was in Jeevan's part where he was with his family and they
and
died.
His whole family died.
And he didn't get it. Yeah, so he was immune.
Biologically, that has to be the case. I don't think, I think there is always... some kind of, maybe I'm just comforting myself.
What I meant was if you get it, you die. It's not that if you, there's no recovering from it, right? It's if you get it, they say you're dead in a couple of days, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no
instance of someone being sick and then recovering, I think. So, okay. Yeah.
But I mean, speaking of Miranda, like I thought, I don't know, I thought that was maybe like a bait and switch. Like she's,
yeah,
where is she? Like Manila or? Like
somewhere in Malaysia, I
think. Some like island nation basically, and I'm like, oh, she's on an island, like maybe they're okay. And you know, and it's interesting too because she is not really aware of anybody around her being sick. Mm-hmm. You know, and then everybody apparently just comes down with this and she contracts it too.
Yeah, and she's actually the only POV we get of a person getting sick. So yeah, so I did get that sense, especially with that early insight of her being delirious on the beach. I obviously thought she had it maybe, but I wasn't sure if she'd actually die because it doesn't, you know, overtly say she dies like some of the other people. But then, yeah, we do get her as the person who is the only one that we see actually getting sick and dying directly.
Yeah, so I just wanted to know, did any of you have a particular character that you liked more than others? Or I mean, I liked Kirsten, I liked Jeevan, but I don't think we really get to know. It never really goes super deep. It's more about what they're going through than themselves. I guess Arthur is the one that we really get all the story of and from when he was a child. But we can just talk about Arthur because Arthur is the thread that kind of ties everyone together, Arthur and Miranda. But what did you guys think of that, using Arthur as the device of the guy who basically dies in the first chapter and yet he's the person who's, you know, overbearing everything else that happens in the book?
Well, I didn't like him much as a character. He kind of, you know, he's not terribly appealing, but it is an interesting device. And I did feel like in some places it was kind of overdone. Like, do we need the paperweight changing hands from him to Miranda, from him to Clark, to him to Miranda, to Kirsten? Like, I don't know if that needed to be there.
To Tanya, to Kirsten.
Oh yeah, Tanya. Yeah, I forgot about her. And obviously, Arthur's not a very nice person, and he's an interesting character, and it's cool to fill in the details in this sort of non sequitur way. I did like that, and those were probably some of my favorite parts of the story, was getting that. So I did like him. I liked Miranda too. I found her perspective to be the most interesting. You know, the whole writing the comic thing. I don't know. She was a very interesting character to be in the head of. And I want to like Kirsten, but like you say, we don't get much. She's the most classically the one you'd want to like, but she felt a little generic to me compared to the other characters.
Yeah, I put down as my favorite character, probably Miranda, just because she kind of seemed to have the most going on in her head and in her heart.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that Arthur was, he definitely got a range. Like, I kind of thought the whole coming from the island thing was almost a little too perfect as a, well, somebody who comes from this amazing place where, you know, you hunt and fish and there's, you know, everybody knows everybody and you're on an island in nature. Like, it almost set him up to be too good. Like, you have to like this guy. He has to be good in his soul because he came from this beautiful place. But I thought that all his misdeeds and his failings were presented in a really human way. Like, you could kind of see how that machine of Hollywood and celebrity in this day and age, you know, can take down anyone. And he didn't start off as a really amazing heroic person. He was just a guy. And so, of course, by the end, he's kind of just a pathetic douche. But I didn't dislike him.
I kind of got the sense that he was the type of person who, I mean, not an inherently bad person. Like, I think his relationship with Kirsten was probably supposed to indicate that he hadn't, you know, lost whatever made him a good person. But at the same time, the whole thing that Miranda observes and that Clark observes, that he's acting while he's around them, I think that more than anything kind of made me think, like, made me dislike him, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, as much as, you know, fame can change someone and be like, oh, I have to leave this wife for this actress and then this actress for this trainer, and then, you know, which also didn't make that much sense. It was kind of just kind of chalked up to, like, human weakness, which is, like, I could understand, but he was, like, marrying them, which made it a little weirder. He was complicated, but, like she almost wanted to make him a, like, a nasty guy. And I'm not, this isn't a criticism, I just, like, but she kind of stopped just ahead, or, like, just gave him just enough good pieces to keep him marginally, like, or to not be like, when Kirsten kept thinking about him, like, ugh, that douchebag, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing for me is that he is very human, and I think the problem maybe with that idea of it being weird that he's marrying them and then breaking it up is that we're missing, obviously, a lot of information. We're skipping a lot of time, so we don't get to see these marriages really go bad, except maybe Miranda, we kind of get that last moment, you know? And I do think it's a relatable, well-realized character to have that, you know, human, like, just keeps breaking everything, and he's going in circles, and you know, the part about him acting around people, I think that is the thing I dislike most about his character, but it is very relatable, that whole, like, dramatic feeling more about himself than he does of others. Like, the best example of this I can think of is when he's writing, well, the writing the letters, like, I don't know, it just seems like he's very invested in his own existence, and something about that puts me off.
Is that where he's writing Victoria you're talking about? Yes, I would agree.
Okay, who was Victoria?
Just a friend from the island. We don't
really childhood know. Friend.
Yeah. Oh, we weren't supposed to, like, realize that she was somebody.
Yeah, that I she thought was I missed somebody. Something too.
I thought that was leading somewhere, but no, it turns out that we never met her because we're never on the island with him, really. But he was. They mentioned later that she was, like, going through a tough time, and she was a housekeeper, and she had to, like, sell the letters for money or something. I think
the other thing too was at the end, him being all about, you know, like, not having any worldly possessions. I don't know, just something about him, like, just, like, very invested in doing the, and, like, thinking out his actions and what they mean, and it is very, like, an actor kind of thing, like, what the significance of everything I do. And I don't know, that is a little bit off-putting, but I do like it as a character trait.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you can only afford to get rid of all your possessions and move to Israel if you have a bunch of money, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little disingenuous.
And trust me, you can only buy an apartment in Jerusalem if you have a ton of money.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about just the setup of the world that we get, you know, because 20 years later is about the farthest that we see, but we get, like, glimpses of year two, year three, year four, year five, and the one complaint that this book gets is that it's a hopeful apocalypse, and Janet Maslin, who reviewed it for the New York Times, she's usually really even-handed, and she rarely, like, is vehement about books, but she had this kind of, like, scathing line saying that a pandemic shouldn't be so hopeful, and do you guys think this actually was hopeful? I don't think it actually was. I think that just the fact that so many people died, there weren't as many people left to cause trouble. I mean, when 999 whatever percent of people die, you're not going to have roving armies of cannibal bands, because there's going to be a ton of stuff available, at least right after the fact.
Okay, it was something that occurred to me. I don't think the argument is as strong 20 years in the future. Mm-hmm. I wanted more detail, like, okay, what are you guys eating, and where are you getting your water, and is stuff still, you know, because, like, drinking out of a stream nowadays, I don't care if you're in the Canadian wilderness, would be psychotic. You know, 20 years in the future, have the chemicals all flushed out, like, you know, I'm curious about that kind of thing, and she seemed interested in them enough that I was wondering why. Do they dig latrine pits every night, the circus? Like, what do they do, you know? I was curious why she didn't go into that. But, like, I think the point where, like, the actual apocalypse didn't seem rough enough to me was when Jeevan left his apartment. And, first of all, I was like, why? Like, why? Why would you leave? Like, I'm just going to go out
and
the wilderness. Why? Okay, go to the other apartments in the building. Like, I mean, he's not going to find food. I mean, I guess he did, but, like, out in the wilderness, is he? I don't
know. Well, I think he just was trying to get to some place, because at that point he didn't know if this was every. I mean, they knew everywhere had it, but if there was a town somewhere, or you know, and he was always watching people leaving the city through the binoculars and everything. But
there's a degree of a lack of logic to his decision making that I think fits the situation. Like, he's not thinking totally clearly because he's just desperate for something. He wants to find something that. Because he's, you know, been so starved of interaction. He is Frank, but after that he has nothing and he needs something, it feels like.
Yeah. Well, and that was what everyone else was doing, right? Was, you know, roads were flooded out to the airport, or, you know, everybody thinks that, okay, just because I have no communication here and I don't know what's going on here, I should go somewhere else, when really, you know, there's nowhere to go, but nobody knows that at this point.
And that's one of the most terrifying things that the characters have to come to terms with, is that the government is not going to come, there's not going to be the Red Cross showing up, passing out blankets and saying everything's okay. And the people that can understand that are the people that make it, like Clark and his friend, you know, who could sort of separate from what was going on, and it's the people who had families and who couldn't let go of the old world that really lose it.
So in terms of, like, the apocalypse not being, like, apocalyptic enough, so, I mean, that point, again, like, Jeevan, what did you pack? What are you wearing? Like, did you see anybody with guns? Like, he just kind of meets, like, these nice people and travels with them for a while. And it's not necessarily that I have a problem with that. It's just that I feel like she was more interested in, like, the lack of humanity than, like, in what this would necessarily do to humanity. Do you know what I mean?
It's a tricky thing because, I like you say, it's sort of teetering on the edge of giving us that detail that kind of explains how things are, what's going on with the ferals, what's going on with how they survive. But we only get brief glimpses, and that can be a source of frustration where we're not getting a lot. But I do think that this story, especially with the way it's narrated, isn't interested in really exploring that detail. And that can be a source of frustration, but I think that is, again, very intentional and not really an oversight.
I definitely didn't think it was hopeful. I mean, just because the last paragraph is some old guy, you know, waxing poetic. I mean, I think overall it's still fairly brutal. And it's hard to say, you know, like watching, I think at some point I mentioned watching The Walking Dead, and it's like, you know, every week there's some new group of people that's out to get you, and it's not the zombies that you have to worry about, it's the people. But really, in this situation where there aren't a lot of people left after 20 years, there was some passage where they were talking about, yeah, there's these religious cults, but we just kind of steer clear of them and they do their own thing. You know, after that long, people do kind of seem to coalesce into groups where order rules, and people, you know, fall into the thing that we all do, which is, you know, kind of follow rules to better or worse. It was like at the very end when the kid shoots the prophet, I totally didn't see that coming, because it's that whole thing of, you just do what you're told. This is what we always do, so this is what we're going to do. And at 20 years out, it, you know, there's probably not a lot of that kind of stepping out of boundaries.
Yeah, you almost, or I at least got the sense that at the 20-year mark, like, it almost felt like the world was winding down. Like, there wasn't this of drive to rebuild, and you get a little bit at the end where that you do see the town with the electric lights in the distance, but they talk about how, like, the buildings are falling apart and no one's making anything that can last again, and they're running out of bullets, and it's different where a lot of similar fiction is, you know, you've got some strong, you know, like even to Walking Dead, like a governor character, someone like that who's trying to hold the old world together. And it doesn't seem like any of these towns really have that. Even like, you know, the guy's doing his newspaper, but like no one else is. It's like, it's just like a passion project. He's not lighting a fire under anyone. I like how it's kind of breaks the mold of the typical post-apocalyptic novel in that.
Yeah, I think the hopeful parts might have been a source of contention because of the way they're sort of done. So you have the newspaper guy, and the question then becomes, why do we have him? What is his significance? What is the meaning? What is the result? And that is a question I felt a lot in this book that I don't necessarily think needs to be asked. I don't think this book is trying to get answers of those kind. And also like things like at the end when they see the town with electricity, like what is the result of this? We never actually get to see it. Why does that matter? And also a big one for me was the shipping fleet. Like I know it's an image that Miranda and I also suspect the author was very into based on the acknowledgments, but it was one that felt like it was hinted at it would be more meaningful in the context of the narrative, but didn't really amount to anything. So there were those things that felt like they should be more than they were.
Well, if you've seen Waterworld, then you know that Dennis Hopper takes one of those ships and he gets some jet skis, yeah, and the smokers are born. So there's, yeah, that.
That's what I wanted to happen, and it didn't. So.
Maybe there'll be a part two. If her editors want this book to be as popular as Hunger Games, they're banging on her door to write the, you know, what happened to her 21.
It's a sequel, but it's literary.
Station 12.
Station 12. Perfect.
Is there talk of that?
No, I don't think so. It's a literary novel. They don't
like
do
it's a well regarded. It's a well regarded book, but it's not like the next Hunger Games.
So. No.
We'll talk a little bit about. There's a couple passages about how the children who are born after it or who are young enough to forget the old world are actually better off. I kind of like understand that, but I've read, you know, like enough of this, and I always like the old crotchety guy who's like sitting in the corner waxing philosophical about, you know, television and the internet. I don't think it's a good thing to forget, even if you can't have it again. And I think the people that let it go are almost taking the easy way out. But do you think actually that the kids who were born with no memory of microwave ovens and Tang actually have it better? Tang. That's again for the postman. Sorry, I don't treat Tang.
I was like, I don't remember Tang.
I'm channeling the postman. He goes, we walked on the moon once, Abby. You've obviously forgotten microwave ovens. And, yeah, okay, anyway.
I don't think that the novel, like, as much as it's like the world is winding down, I think that the electricity coming back and, you know, the idea of the sparks of the internet still hanging around, I think that means something. So I don't necessarily think we're supposed to be like, it's never coming back, just let it go. But at the same time, you know, I think that Mandel wants us to think about how much we would miss, you know, 99% of the planet dies, and what are we missing? The internet, you
right.
know?
And that's almost a joke about that one guy who like powers up his bicycle to get enough electricity, and what is he doing? He's looking for the internet. Mm-hmm. And I just want to read this one passage, which it's weird. Some of the chapters are 20 pages long and some of them are just a paragraph, but right when everyone starts to die from the flu, it's this one paragraph of just of no more, like no more this, no more that. And I just want to read part of it where she says, no more internet, no more social media, no more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches, cries for help and expressions of contentment and relationship status updates with heart icons, whole or broken. Plans to meet up later, please, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others, and in so doing, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars. So she's definitely like commenting on, you know, the superficiality of how we all live online these days, and I don't think she'd miss that, but of course that's what people are trying to get back.
See, I thought that like that was a little like heavy-handed. I didn't really like that.
Yeah.
I was like,
okay. I share her views, so maybe that's
well, I mean, it was also like every time, like, and I don't even know that this is unrealistic. I'm just saying, like, every time they were like, you used to open a door and cold air would come out, and I was like, okay, I get it. They're missing refrigeration. I understand. You know, again, not necessarily a bad thing, but I did sort of think, like, I'm smart enough to understand that I should be thinking about the impact of technology and how I'd miss that without you having to tell me to miss it, you know?
Right.
I think the most affecting passage in that regard for me is when Clark is commenting on how this is the last orange I'm probably ever going to have, and that the decay of like infrastructure means so many like luxury food commodities that you enjoy every day you can no longer have, like mangoes, papayas, all gone. I think that was the most touching for me. Like Facebook.
Well, that reminds me of the can of Coke in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's fizzy.
I hate that book so much.
that book kills me. I can't read it. I have read it, but I can't, like, it. I can't do it, you know?
It gave me, and this book did a little bit too, tangent, but, like, it gave me what I call, like, road vision, which is, like, for, like, a week after I read that book, I was, like, walking around being like, what would this look like in the apocalypse? Oh, my God, I'm seeing, like, these bodies of all these people. I'm like, what's useful in this house? Oh, no, it's gone already.
And I think that's the success of this book, that it can invest you to the degree of something like that. I do think that the fact that it lingers with you, I mean, it's part of the medium and the style and the, I guess, genre too, but I think this book does a very good job of achieving that.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that in a way made it so relatable, I mean, the constant references to the internet, it just felt like it was very, very much of this time of the year, you know, 2014, 15, whatever. And that almost more than anything else kind of took me out of it, because it's like, you know, okay, in 10 years, is somebody going to be able to pick up this book and relate to it? It really works now. And it was very affecting to read now and think, wow, if this happened today, you know, all this shit would be important. But, you know, 10, 20 years from now in this timeline, you know, things are going to be completely different.
Yeah, that's why the road works better, I think, because there's very few things to tie it down to. It's just, it's a light book in that it's dark in what it goes through, but it's light. And, you know, it could take place in 100 years, in 150 years, or 30 years ago. You don't really know. And that's one of its strengths. But yeah, I don't know if this book will hold up in that sense. But for what it is, you know, breaking the molds and sort of opening up the world of literary fiction to this kind of stuff, I think it'll leave a stamp, even if it doesn't hold up on rereads in 50 years.
But does it open up the world? I mean, like, you know, we're just going through the books that we've read that are post-apocalyptic and, you know, I mean, The Road, obviously, and there's a bunch more that are coming out. Like, I don't feel like this is as revolutionary as people want it to be, you know? Like, they almost want to be like, oh my gosh, that genre that only teenagers read, somebody did it pretty, you know? But, like, I don't feel like that's actually the case. I mean, I have plenty of issues with The Hunger Games, but I think those are pretty well-written books. I'm not saying they're, like, amazing literary fiction, but, you know, just this idea that, like, again, Cormac McCarthy, not exactly a slouch, you know?
No, not at all. Just that there has been this resurgence in literary fiction using science fiction tropes, and now all these authors are getting nominated for Booker Awards and National and Book Awards, and that didn't happen before. And even this year, you've got this one, you've got Howard Jacobson, who wrote this post-apocalyptic one, and it's set in England, and it's just like, it seems to be the cool thing to do at the moment. And
that's maybe weird to me, though, because I think that it has been at least a thematic thing that has been very consistent through literary fiction for a long time. Maybe not this very specific sort of style of it, where it's post-apocalyptic sci-fi in the manner that we see in a lot of those genre fiction examples. But, you know, I mean, you can even go back to, like, someone like Yeats, or even way before, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, you can think of plenty of examples of the whole "the center cannot hold things falling apart" sort of mentality.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
And I mean, then you have David Mitchell, right? Who's just screw you guys. I'm writing whatever I want, and it's going to be literary.
Well, now, like, people think that David Mitchell is too genre-y, like, he's too mainstream now, so he's not going to get the, the literary crowd anymore.
God, I hate this. I feel like we should force Alex to say something.
Yeah, what would you like to talk about, Alex?
I don't know. I think
Ben, you're on the podcast. No. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
There's this very strange cognitive dissonance with the Traveling Symphony itself, where there's this last vestige of, like, high culture and these thespians and artists, but at the same time they're skull-cracking badasses who can dispatch brigands effortlessly.
The irony is real there, for sure. I can feel it. But I like that. I like that dissonance. I think it was cool.
They say survival is inefficient, or survival is not sufficient enough.
But it's good to have. So.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings up the question of, you know, what do we think we would do? Just, I think Frank's way out sounded pretty awesome. To just be comfortable in your bed and just, like, okay, I'm gonna stop this now. And it's your decision. It's a coward's way out, but at the same time, it doesn't sound unpleasant compared to the alternative.
Well, I think if he could walk, I don't think he would have done that. It's that he knew his options, and he took, you know, he didn't do it immediately. He threw himself into his work, and he did that as long as he possibly could.
So there's a little bit of theory crafting. Did you guys think the memoir he was writing was for Arthur? Because the only connection I can think of is that the immortality thing is mentioned, and Arthur directly references that in his, I guess, third omniscient monologue. that he has.
I thought it could, but I didn't think it would have been possible because Arthur only started doing his philanthropy stuff like in as he was dying. Like there wasn't time for him to contract a ghostwriter, I don't think. Yeah. Unless he was doing it on the sly.
That would have probably been too much connection, I think, to have that.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit too, because there's everyone is connected, but it's almost too perfect, you know, but I always have to realize that that's the author knows the story before they write it, so she's going to know that these characters all are together. But it seemed almost too perfect that, like, you know, Jeevan passes. There's all these little. Jeevan is the one it starts out with, but you know, with the comic book getting passed from Tyler to you know to Miranda, and then Miranda to Kirsten, and it just seemed like a little too. You know, everything fit together too perfectly.
It made me want to go back and read it again, which I don't actually want to read it again right now, but it was a little annoying, actually. Like, oh, okay, all this shit's coming together and I wasn't paying attention. So who gave who what now? And where does this, you know, I kind of had to, when I started figuring out that, oh, Tyler's the prophet, when I was like, damn it.
Prophets. Scripture, where he's reading the testament, like at the very first part he does that, you're like, oh shit, he's the guy. And to a degree, that is a little annoying. I think it's one of those things where the author is doing the thing where they make the reader feel clever for figuring stuff out, and that is a device.
I felt so clever.
That is a device that works in terms of making your reader feel good about reading. Yeah, I guess this book has some replay value.
What point did you guys go like, oh, there's a connection? Because for me, it was like when we found out that Miranda's dog was named Luli.
Well, I was still curious about that because we don't figure that out until the very end when we figure out he has the comics. That's why. And the name is in the comics because I remember it being briefly mentioned in that scene where she's in his office and she thinks to name the dog in the story, the Pomeranian in the story, that. But I didn't put it together, that one, until the very end.
No, I didn't get it until he was reading like the Book of Revelation to the quarantine plane and Clark is like, starts talking to him, and
For Tyler being the prophet, I got that super early. Yeah. I was way ahead on that one.
Oh, way to go.
Oh, I didn't get that. But I got that there was some kind of connection when not when Miranda was thinking of naming the dog. That was when I figured out how it happened, but like I remember that the prophet was like, dog, Luli, and then I was like, and it was like, Miranda's dog, Luli, and I was like, that's definitely not the same dog, so what's going on there?
Yeah, so that's what I was thinking, was like, why is his dog, why does he have that connection to Miranda? Because so far we have no connection between Tyler and Miranda until we discover that he has the Station 11 comics at the end.
I think I beat Greg on the prophet thing by probably just a couple pages, but I feel like the paperweight was the first thing that stuck out to me.
That is one of the more superficial ones, though. Like, there's not a lot of meaning tied to it other than it just passing between hands and kind of getting to see where it went in a non-sequitur way. That was probably one of the weaker ones for me, I think.
Has anyone seen the film Babel?
Yes.
With Brad Pitt? Structurally, this book reminded me of that film very much. That despite all these characters being, from what we see, very closely interrelated, they're very much isolated. There's all this trauma and anxiety, and they have trouble connecting with people. I haven't seen that film in so long.
I just remember falling asleep several times throughout it, but I did see it on DVD and I liked it the second time. But no, that's a good point. I feel like that movie, like, you had to work. It made you work, you know?
Yes.
And I kind of like that more in books, not in movies so much. I just want to enjoy it.
And I think this is a book that did make you work a little bit, and I did enjoy that process for some of it. I liked the organization for the most part. I liked the interview between her and the librarian guy whose name I can't remember, kind of being slowly revealed in different perspectives, from Clark's perspective and so on. I liked that kind of stuff. I liked that it was kind of piecing itself together.
Right. Some things I thought they waited too long to reveal, like the thing with the tattoos. Like, I figured, like, what else could the tattoos mean?
Obvious what those meant.
But the way they drew it was like, I'm not going to talk about the tattoos, and then they finally did. It was like, yeah, that's
probably. They're tattoos of knives on her arm, are like a number of them, obviously, when they view people she's killed. Come on.
But there's one thing I thought was going to happen, and I thought she was making it super obvious, so that's probably why it didn't happen, but the whole connection between Tyler and the plane that was quarantined, did anyone else think that he was going to try to get back there to try to, like, open it up and unleash a second wave of disease among everybody? Because I thought that's because Clark mentioned that jet in every single page almost. Mm. And of course it's there, like, he lives with that in the shadow of it, but I thought that was one thing where he was going to come back and try to, like, you know, make everybody sick and kill everybody now.
Yeah, I thought.
Did anyone else think that Tyler was going to try and do something?
Yeah.
I think that's probably the biggest failing of the book in terms of like a plot thing, because that plot line just completely fizzles out. I mean, like there's that one tense standoff that ends. And then, okay, we'll just go to the airport now.
I felt exactly the same way, but again, I think this is deliberate. I think this book is not trying to have a dramatic climax where we get to see it all come together. And to a degree, I felt the same way. I was like, that's how it ends, really? We had so much buildup, and that's it. I did feel that, but again, I think that the book is not trying to be that.
See, I was so happy that happened because I felt so much relief.
Yeah, that's a thing too.
And I didn't want, because if it did that, then that would have kind of fell into what, you know, every post-apocalyptic book has got the crazy religious leader or the crazy fundamentalist guy who's trying to start a new society and go, and he's gonna, you know, kidnap people, rape people, and do his thing. And this one, this guy gets shot by a kid, and it's over. And his dog becomes her friend. And I was like, oh, that's nice. Now let's go to the airport, follow the yellow brick road. Let's go meet the wizard.
I was glad that when that did happen though, and it was really abrupt. That okay, shoo, there's still plenty of pages. Like it didn't just chop off the story. The whole point has kind of been detailing the world and seeing what has happened. And so you got to continue to see a little further on. I did kind of think there was some point after they got to the airport and Clark's like, oh, I'll tell you tomorrow about the Station 11, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, he was going to die.
And I was like, oh my God, he's going to die. He's totally going to die right now. And I was glad that he didn't.
What I hated was that once we get that little resolution and then there's like 60 pages left and then you turn to the next section and it's Arthur from like when he was like, oh great, now it's 40 pages of Arthur and then 5 of the actual story I really care about. You know, I kind of felt cheated every time it went back to Arthur. I get it that he's the thread, but I wish more of the book was set in the year 20 because most of the book is actually set before, and it's really more of a pre-apocalyptic book, or just a, you know, showing what's wrong with society in our day.
I feel like this could be partly due to background, because I think that if this book was like a sort of George R. R. Martin style, like super long epic, then it would have lots of that cool stuff that we want to see, like what happens next. And again, I think this book is trying to be more concise with that stuff, but I do think it did fall pretty flat at the ending. It didn't end in a strong way, I think.
Yeah, see, the thing I have a problem with in terms of Tyler and the whole prophet thing is that, and maybe this is part of marketing, you know, not necessarily Emily Mandel's fault, but, you know, like, the front cover of the book is like the flap is like, you know, when Kirsten gets entangled with, you know, the creepy town of St. Deborah on the water, which they leave in the first 15 pages. And, you know, and like, and this creature, you know, comes into the eye of the prophet. And it's like, there are things like the electricity coming back that I don't need to know the end of, you know, like I'm perfectly content with that just being there. But then there are things with like, I feel like if the prophet thing was important enough to be a part of the story, then there should have been some other fall. I mean, Dieter, the guy who dies, like, it's a freaking mistake, you know? I mean, and not that there's anything wrong with that. I just felt like there was some element of it that needed to be pulled taut, and there wasn't any element of it, you know? I mean, like, they even, you know, there's no, like, why does he dig the graves? You know, whatever. It's like, the whole first part of the book, for me, seemed to function on atmosphere, and there was no, like, pull-through for the atmosphere.
And I think that is a thing you can call this book out on. I think that there is, partially, just this writer didn't really achieve that narrative climax, that sort of strong finish that a lot of, I mean, that's a hard thing to do to achieve that. Yeah. So,
but also I think she's telling the story of society as a whole more than any single person's story. Yeah. So that's why
it's okay. It's not what this story wants to be necessarily, but I do agree. It was a weakness, for me, just from me enjoying the story. It's just like, oh yeah, if we kill him, we'll take his dog. I kind of sympathize him. He's the same comics as me, and that's it.
Yeah.
I sort of prefer, rather than having sort of governor-esque big bad human antagonist, that the prophet does sort of feel inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, and that he's sort of off abruptly and what's left of society just rumbles on.
It does seem a little more almost realistic that way, and less like a movie or a or well, book, I guess, but you know, where it's built up and there's all this action, you know, it's more just, you know, this is what happens in these people's lives and, you know, they go on.
Yeah. It's a tricky thing. Yeah, I don't buy it. I buy that sometimes. it just life goes on and I understand that, but still, you do always have to ask that question when you're reading stuff like this, like, so what? Why do I care? And there was definitely some of that for me. And I still love the book, but I did feel that too.
For me, it kind of called into question the relevance of Station 11, like, you know, which is... Hi, doggy. Oh. I assume that was somebody's dog. I don't know.
That's Lily.
Oh. but I forgot what I was saying.
Relevance of Station 11.
Yeah, comics. Right. Relevance of Station 11. You know, which becomes this link between Tyler and Kirsten that neither of them ever really understand. And I you know, when it ends like that and it's just this brief moment of connection, I don't know. Like, I didn't really understand, like, where Tyler got all that crazy from, you know? I mean,
his mom, I think, whole idea of them being the chosen people, you know, it was this thing going back and forth, and he had only very few things to entertain them. One happened to be the Book of Revelation, which in those circumstances can be, you know, trouble.
Were you guys disappointed that we didn't find out what happened to Kirsten in year one?
I think if we got it, it would have been as awful as we think it was, you know? Mm. Something pretty bad went down, and no, I'm not disappointed particularly, because we didn't get really anybody in year one. It was kind of in just brief little sentences as to what happened.
Yeah.
We only really get, what's his name?
Jeevan.
And Jeevan, for me, was one of the, in terms of connections, was the weakest. Obviously, he has a lot going on with Arthur throughout his life, and that's interesting. But at the end, he's, like, so separate in the post-collapse world. He is so separate from everyone else. I have a hard time, like, thinking of why he's relevant there.
Picture her writing this and then getting that person, like, oh crap, I haven't read about Jeevan in 200 pages, and then he's living in this little nice little hamlet in Virginia, and of course, you know, the prophet is the thread, you know, there that they pass through there at some point.
But how did the prophet get all down there and then back up, like, or because Tyler starts in the airport, but then he ends up down in Virginia and then he's back.
Yeah, they go around. Yeah.
It's been 20 years. That's true. He's proselytizing all over America.
But did anyone else have, because, like, if a book's not set in an area that I know about, I like to know, you know, where it's actually taking place. And we have this, you know, giant road atlas at work, and I was actually had this open and to, like, the Michigan, the Mitten and everything. And I was trying to find specific towns, but the only actual town she mentions is Traverse City. And there's New Petoskey, which there is a town Petoskey. And we know it's on, like, the eastern coast of Lake Michigan. But there is no Severn City, and I think Severn City could be. It's obviously not Traverse City because they do mention Traverse City, but in that general area. But I don't know this area really, and it was nice to, like, actually look at. And I was looking at, like, the bridge over into, you know, across Mackinac. Into Canada Mackinac Bridge, and they mentioned how that, like, collapsed at one point. And I really liked the fact that it wasn't set in, like, New York or Los Angeles. I mean, parts of it were New York, but and then the collapse of Toronto. But it was really refreshing that it was a little different, and I like that.
Yeah, I lived in Michigan for a while, so it was kind of cool. Like, I've been to Traverse City many times, and so it was kind of cool to get that feeling. And I actually have a weird story because do you guys remember that in 2003 that blackout that happened?
I do.
Yeah, so I was moving from Massachusetts to Michigan through Canada that day when it happened. So it's kind of weird reading this book because it kind of gave me, like, I don't know, like, flashbacks or something to that. That was probably, like, the most end of days thing I ever experienced. Yeah, geographically, it was very similar to where I was.
Well, I like secretly love blackouts because I'm obsessed with post-apocalyptic culture. That every blackout, you have that moment of this could be it.
I'm ready. It's time. And,
oh, I'm never ready, but, like, this could be the one, like, they might not, the lights might not be coming back on.
Yeah, so that was a cool thing for me. I liked it. I liked the setting.
I was actually trying to find out, like, what airport this is, and I think it's the Cherry City Airport, which is right outside of Traverse City. Like, I was looking at pictures of it, and it does have a lot of glass enclosures, and it looks like this could be where it's actually set, so it's cool.
I thought they were going south for some reason. I thought they were going towards Ohio.
Yeah, but they were going, like, south from the top of, is it the panhandle?
Yeah. They were in the upper peninsula, yeah.
So the peninsula, yeah. So they're, you know, I think that could be it. They mentioned, like, a lake, the lake, but you don't get a specific, and, you know, there is no, like, St. Deborah by the water or anything like that. But, yeah, I'd like to place my stories when I can.
Look at a map and didn't.
That's all right.
Did you guys buy the whole, like, foods, like, you know, the food ran out at the thing, so some people decided to hunt, and, you know, there's enough food for this entire airport population, and then after that, like, you know, the toilets still work, and I don't know why I'm fixating on these little details, I just feel like...
Again, I think this is George R. R. Martin syndrome, and that sort of
maybe it covers all bases.
And I did have those thoughts, too, but I don't think the story wants to explore them.
Yeah, I kind of wondered where they were getting water from at the airport after years and years.
Well, the winter, I guess it makes sense.
No, you melt snow, but I mean, also there, the woods, I mean, it's pretty rural once you get a couple miles outside of the city there, and there's plenty of game, and you know, they did have the guy from the TSA who knew how to hunt, so plus there were only like 80 people there, it wasn't like they were feeding an entire city, so I think it was, and they, you know, they dug up the parts of, you know, and planted their garden and stuff, so I thought it was pretty realistic, but the, it was one interesting thing where she said as she was writing this, she didn't know that, like, gasoline would only last a couple years, and it wasn't until she was reading The Dog Stars by Peter Heller, because they had the same editor, which is another really great, you know, post-apocalyptic novel, but it's got a lot of other stuff going on, that she realized that they couldn't have gasoline in you know, years later, that only airplane fuel actually would last much longer, but even that eventually would go stale.
Which I thought was a really cool, I just thought it was a really cool detail. I didn't know that.
I'm very interested in the process of crafting a world like this that's post-apocalyptic with this circumstance of having so much of the old world and trying to figure out how to repurpose it, but obviously you don't have any electricity or anything like that. I love that idea, so it was something I wanted to read more of, how that world was built, but again, I think that's a lot of research the author has to do that probably just didn't get done, and again, probably wasn't a thing they wanted to focus on, but that is something I'm very fascinated by, so I wanted that stuff, and I did like the bits we got.
That was my favorite section, I think, was Clark's, you know, five or six chapters of, you know, landing at the airport and getting to year 20 and seeing the different, how different people handle it. And she kind of got away with it there because the airport's a perfect place because they've got restaurants, they've got, you know, facilities, they've got wide open spaces. They're relatively, you know, isolated from a roving horde of starving, you know, people. So it was the best place he could have possibly been.
Yeah. They have that sign that says turn back so no one ever shows up. So.
That was also maybe my favorite scene where that one guy makes it in and he drops his gun and I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
Because there's just so few people left in the world.
I mean, that is a little overwrought. That is a little dramatic, but it was a good scene.
Oh, I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. Yeah, me too. So I guess we should talk about the Museum of Civilization, because that's kind of the that's where everybody meets, and it's kind of the you know, the focal point of the novel, or one of the focal points. Did you find it realistic the way it came together, and do you think that that's a good, necessarily good idea, or is it a constant reminder of, you know, what's gone and what we can't have anymore?
Well, we have museums of civilization now.
Yeah, museums.
Right, exactly.
And I love, you know, it's funny, she was listing the things that he had in there, and so much of it seems so mundane, but when I think of times, like, I love to go into an old historical house that, you know, has the rooms roped off, and they have the clothes on mannequins, and I love just that everyday, day-to-day stuff of like, okay, what do these people do? You know, not what great feats of whatever did they accomplish, but, you know, what do they do when they got up in the morning? What do they brush their teeth with? And, you know, just those little human touches that I thought were a cool thing to keep mementos of, regardless of whether you think you should just stop teaching people about the past or not.
And we do get that passage in there about the snow globe and all the things that are human about it. And again, that's another thing you could say, oh, this is too much, but I did like that. And I think that is a very true, realistic thing that I can totally buy a person like Clark or anyone being and the other people that are fascinated by just being so caught up in the value of these objects, that they have their significance well beyond what they seem. I do like that idea. Whether or not it's a good thing in terms of whether society should hang on to that stuff, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I think it depends on the person.
We'll have to wait and find out after it falls apart and see who visits, what kind of numbers they get.
Visit back on this pod. Oh, wait, we can't do that. Shoot.
We'll all meet in New Petoskey or Severn City, whatever.
We have very low chance of all surviving in this city, so, I mean, hope. Obviously,
I will
we're destined,
say,
obviously.
We're the characters.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're the light, actually.
Light. We are the light.
Well, one unexpected detail, speaking of what did they brush their teeth with, was like Kirsten like poking at like where her teeth had fallen out, and I was like, oh my god, toothpaste.
toilet paper.
Adding to post-apocalyptic plan, toothpaste.
And the thing she wants most is a dentist. Like, I love that. I think that was actually one of the few character details I really liked about Kirsten, whereas I felt like in many other ways she wasn't too interesting, but I did like that part in some other ones.
Yeah, Greg, one question you had on the doc is just about, like, what would we miss if, you know, because she did make such a point about stressing the internet and the, you know, the technological stuff that we all take for granted. But when I was trying to think of, okay, what would I really need? It's like hot water, heat, air conditioning would be pretty awesome. But, you know, just those very basic necessities that are make you comfortable.
I would miss you guys because the connection
you got. You stole mine.
Got it.
Although I did lose my, I broke my phone the other day and was without a phone for about a full 24 hours. And it was pretty lame. And then it kind of reminded me of when I wasn't on the forums too much when the forums went down for that couple months or whatever it was. But, you know, I can imagine. That would just be terrible.
Yeah. I think, well, I definitely would miss the internet. I mean, it's sad to me, like, how often I check my phone. And like, I mean, I don't do internet or electronic on Saturdays, and I'm like, it's really good, but it's also really hard, you know? And like, when it's over, I'm always like, oh my God, what happened in these 24 hours? You know, like, and inevitably, like, it's hardly ever anything. But it, you know, like, just now, I can't even tell you how many times I've checked my mail while we've been talking. Again, so dumb, right? But like, but yes, I would also miss comfortable stuff. I'm a comfort person. I like to be warm and not in pain.
Yeah, it's a weird thing for me to reconcile because there's a part of me that is fascinated by that idea of living a more, I don't know, more life with more stakes, something, you know, that where survival is a concern, where you aren't living, like, this is the quote from the book, like, the high-functioning sleepwalker. I feel like sometimes I'm in that state, and I feel like if I were to survive something like this, I'd have a better chance of escaping that. And but still, yeah, like, losing all those, like, comforts, like, obviously it would be horrible and terribly full of suffering kind of thing, but it is definitely a weird feeling.
I mean, I think that attitude also, like, is fixed easily enough by realizing that it happens.
We don't need an apocalypse to recover.
I mean, it's
from
like,
our
you know,
state,
like,
state existence.
I always think of people who are like, you know, oh, well, you know, childhood used to be dangerous and like before we had vaccines, and it's like, yeah, deeply missed that time. You know, like, come on. Not that you're saying that, Doc. I'm just having my own little mini rant right now.
No, yeah, I totally agree. It is a thought I have. Do you guys never, like, think of what life would be like in the post-apocalypse? Surely you guys think, like...
every day.
Well, speaking of the renewal of resources, which is part of what made, I think, the road so terrifying, because that was, like...
this finite feeling.
Right, and it seemed like there was no potential for planting or whatever. But something that was curious to me was, like, once the electricity went on in that town, it occurred to me, like, well, why didn't, you know, once the plague was over in, like, year 3 or 4 or whatever, like, those electricity stations are still there. Like, those don't actually run off of any theoretical resources, right? They're just, like, it's water or, you know, like, it's a power plant. I mean, does it not need gasoline? Am I exposing my idiocy once again?
Planet of the Apes. Strong monkeys to move some rocks.
If people still know how to activate the grid, like, know how to make it work, then that could theoretically, I mean, that's how they get it back running. But it's not like some other things where literally the electricity can't be, like, it's gone. You can't get it back. But I think that it's just a question of getting the right people in the right place.
Right. So, I mean, like, Clark's whole thing, like, the end of it, I was here for the end of electricity, and I was a little bit like, hey, hang on, dude. You know, like, somebody's
not over.
But God, those toilets must have broken in those 20 years, though. I mean, come on.
We don't know. I think we get the toilets only working, like, a few weeks after. I don't think we actually get them directly referenced as being used. Wait later.
I feel like there was in the...
I know they say the thing about, like, putting water in them to flush, but I think that was still relatively soon after.
Yeah, but you can still go into the bathroom to shave. I mean, it's probably, you know, there's nothing is going to break as long as the sink is still there. The water's not running, but that's believable.
But they kill people in the bathrooms all the time, right? So
something I thought was funny was the fact that all the musicians don't get names. Which was funny to me because, you know, it's like the whole thing about being the orchestra in the pit, not getting any kind of love for your contribution.
Except for Viola.
I've been there, Zach. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's some of them, but it's funny that they're normally, as opposed to the actors, given just like the third cello or not the third, you know what I mean.
I also love the tribalism between the different sections of the orchestra. How is other people know it's flutes?
that actually, it kind of annoyed me because it was so impersonal, and I was like, you guys literally survived together, and you know, for me it kind of threw me off as to how close the troop actually was. Did that have an effect on anybody?
I didn't think it was. I thought it was more like they're almost an army, or they're a group, you know, and it's almost like their roles. It's not just like red shirting people. It's actually, it's, oh, maybe they take pride in the fact that I'm the second oboe, you know, stuff like that. Because you did get a lot of their names also. But yeah, sometimes just calling someone tuba isn't as respectful as giving them a name.
Yeah, it's a stylistic thing. I don't know. I didn't really get that feeling, but I totally get why it would feel like it was impersonal and these people were kind of red shirty, I guess.
It didn't feel red shirty to me. It just felt like jerky. it felt like a jerk move.
Yeah, it's weird because you feel like you're attributing that that way of describing people to Kirsten, but I think that that's not how she would think of those people. I think that's more the narrator.
Yeah, I did kind of take it as a cue to be like, oh, okay, he doesn't have a name, so I don't even have to. Like, there were quite a few people introduced in Kirsten's, you know, first couple chapters, so anybody who was named an instrument, I was just kind of like, oh, whatever.
If you each had to select one item to put in the Museum of Civilization, what would it be?
Oh, dear.
It's in the show notes, guys. You had time to prepare.
I did, but I still couldn't think of anything.
I haven't either. Beforehand. I still don't have one. That's why you guys go first.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something new and unique from apart from what they listed in there. So honestly, I just wrote down, like, stuffies. Like,
it'd probably be something like that.
I would take my most personal item.
It's something that you
personally
have like sentimental value to. I think it would typically be just anything like that.
Yeah.
I would say my father's violin, but it'd probably be part of the traveling symphony. So that's a no.
Yeah, I was thinking I'd probably put my, I have a baseball signed by Willie Mays, Duke Snyder, and Mickey Mantle that, you know, the second the apocalypse happens, that it has no value whatsoever, but it still represents, you know, hey, when people had free time, they cared about things like this, you know, and... it's the one, you know, signed baseball that I've kind of held on to over the years. So I'd probably put that if Clark would take it.
It reminded me of that really sad scene where they go in the house. The little kid in his bed with the baseball.
Oh.
The picture of him in the baseball outfit and the Starship Enterprise figure. Yeah.
Yeah, that. I think that scene was so sad that I kind of forgot about it. But that might have been actually my favorite scene just for what it... You know, I love that idea of like finding a house that hadn't been touched when they thought there were these places didn't exist anymore. It was haunting.
Maybe my Harry Potter books. I don't know.
Those are useful. Like they have an application.
This is true.
You can teach people magic.
Or we could just leave the world of ice and fire and devastatingly confuse future generations.
Then they can wait like we've waited.
Yeah.
I think they'll have a little longer wait if it just comes to pass.
What happened at Summer Hall?
I'd love that to become some prophet's mythology.
I know.
It reminds me of Reign of Fire, the movie called The Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
The survivors in Scotland, they think of Star Wars as like mythic prehistory.
Yeah, it'd be something like sentimental I can't think of right now, but that is where I would lean, and I think that is where it would normally go with that type of thing.
It were just like pictures of like your family, right? So they would be...
But I think Greg is right about like something that doesn't just have personal value to it, has some kind of meaning beyond that. Like you say, like the baseball being something that is so distinct from that era and in terms of what people are interested in. There is that, if I was trying to think of the perfect item, that would be part of my consideration too.
What did you guys think about the title?
I want to read these comics. I feel like it feels a little weak as a framing device. It feels like that the author was interested in just a cool idea that they kind of fit into it. It doesn't fit as neatly as I would have liked, but I do like it, especially from Miranda's standpoint as a, you know, a piece of fiction. I think it sounds cool.
Well, and there was the whole kind of reference to the undersea people and just kind of living in limbo.
Yeah.
You mean, do you think you liked it as an appropriate title, or that it was wrapped up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Did you guys think that it was like the right title for this book?
I think it's a good title just before I knew what the book was about. Like, it didn't mean anything to me, so it's not like year one or something like that. Like, I just liked it because it's mysterious in itself and you have to read the book to find out. So I liked it, but yeah. Like,
you know, I do writing workshops, and that question always comes up, does the title work? And I don't really know how to answer that question, because I feel like it people try to make titles more than they need to be. I think it serves that function of kind of being a thing that is important throughout the story. It's a cool title. I don't know. I think it works fine.
Yeah. I wasn't so satisfied with it, but I mean, I don't know that I have a suggestion that would be like not post-apocalyptic, you know?
Yeah, I don't want like a phrase or something. Like, I don't want it to be called like survival is insufficient or something like that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the traveling
scene. The line from Shakespeare. Like, I thought it could have been called like Lear or that's something. Overdone, you know, though.
Like, and that idea is pretty. I don't know. That'd be kind of lame to me.
Oh, what but come on!
I didn't hear.
I don't know, like Lear. Or, I don't know, some line from Lear. I don't know.
Oh, flies are too wanton boys. We are unto the gods.
Yeah, that's a great.
That kills for their sport.
Let's go with that. Nice.
Wanton boys. The gripping tale of a girl in a post-apocalyptic land.
Like it would have sold much better if it was called Wanton Boys. Remind people what a relic.
I would have given it like five more bloody lemon cakes if that was the title.
It sounds like a steamy fan fiction.
Exactly.
ooh, let me check if there is Station 11 fan fiction already.
I'd like to think that someone would actually make the comic book, because it's only two issues, but I would still want to read that, even though we kind of know the story.
I mean, she never finished it.
That's true. Like,
piece of side content, if someone's willing to do that, I think it'd be a cool thing.
Yeah. Well, the book designer for the UK edition did create the covers for them, so maybe he'll continue that on his own.
Yeah, it'll be in the world of Station 11 that comes out.
Just to end it, I just wanted to read the actual last paragraph of the book, because it encompasses the whole hopefulness of it, and I don't think it's cheesy. I actually really enjoy it, but I think we'll go out on this note. It's basically Clark, who's managed to survive at the airport for 20 years, and he's finally seeing like a flicker of civilization coming back with the lights that are going on. And he says, Clark looks up at the evening activity on the tarmac, at the planes that have been grounded for 20 years, the reflection of his candle flickering in the glass. He has no expectation of seeing an airplane rise again in his lifetime, but it is possible that somewhere there are ships setting out. If there are again towns with streetlights, if there are symphonies and newspapers, then what else might this awakening world contain? Perhaps vessels are setting out even now, traveling toward or away from him, steered by sailors armed with maps and knowledge of the stars, driven by need or perhaps simply by curiosity. Whatever became of the countries on the other side. If nothing else, it's pleasant to consider the possibility. He likes the thought of ships moving over the water toward another world just out of sight.
And that's when the container fleet shows up and saves the day. Yay. I like the consistency of the whole idea of air travel and just traveling being the thing they emphasize in terms of what has changed. You know, they always reference the collapse as being the time that air travel ended or something of that vein. I like that.
Or just how small the world becomes when you don't have that option anymore. Mm-hmm. And I just want to highly recommend the passage by Justin Cronin, because she mentions it even in the afterword that's the book that the character was reading, because in that book it's a similar kind of thing, and then you think the world has ended basically, but it's kind of a spoiler, but you find out the whole world is basically quarantined America, and they've let us die, even though they can go on.
Because 28 days later.
Yeah, but the entire continent, basically, because we've been overrun by unstoppable vampire zombies. But yeah, I'll throw that up as a suggestion for future book clubs, maybe.
And I like that this book didn't do that, didn't have the people saving the day. I'm joking about the whole container fleet thing, though I do wonder why
it was tell.
In. Yeah. But I do wonder why it was in, but yeah, I'm glad this book didn't have the thing where like, it was just over here, it's fine over there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds like it was once you had one infected person, like they were getting reports from all over the world. And
it didn't even start in the U.S., so it's not like you could have even assumed that it would only be there.
Yeah. Damn, Russians. Sorry.
Yeah. There's a comment in the show notes, Greg, about the jingoism of the plague? I didn't quite understand that question.
Oh, I just meant, like, a lot of books that have end of the world type stuff, it always starts off somewhere else. You know, it's a sickness from Africa, or it's the Georgian flu. Like, it's never something from America. Like, it didn't start in America. I meant, did she not want to, like, would it have been a bad thing to have it start off in, you know, to be the Pennsylvania flu or something like that?
I don't think that was put in, that was considered whether people would be upset if it started in America. I think it was part of the idea of it being this sort of shadowy, weird, not understanding thing way off. Kind of how we felt about Ebola before it showed up on our shores, you know, like, yeah. As long as we're not being affected, who cares? Mm. But as soon as we are, it's a big deal. So yeah. I think that was the goal with that.
Yeah, and in Canada, you'd know about it, you know, like, if the story's starting in Toronto, then...
People. Like, not like Americans.
No, I'm saying if it was in Pennsylvania, they'd probably be a lot more concerned in Toronto as opposed to if it's in Georgia.
But I had a real surreal... you guys might have too, just because the height... I mean, the Ebola thing is still going on, but when they were talking about quarantining that nurse, that's right when I was finishing, when I was reading the chapter about Jeevan and when it was all going down, and it was a pretty, like... Yeah, if someone coughed, I was like, yeah, just stay over there.
Well, it's really, like, the pathology of all this is very scary. I mean, like, the New York Times review took it, like, kind of hammered it home in a place that I didn't expect it to, which was, like, you know, Ms. Mandel subscribes to the theory that humanity will be wiped out by a super flu. And I was like, wait, she does? Like, wait. Like, not that I was, like, ever, like, oh, this could never happen, because obviously, you know, it could happen, God forbid, but the fact that she's actually imagining a scenario that she thought could happen seemed a hell of a lot scarier to me than like, oh, what if, you know, like, what if aliens take over the planet? Like, sure, it's an offhand possibility, but I'm not particularly concerned about it. But, like, once the author's like, no, this is how it's going down, I'm a little bit like, whoa, okay.
Well, this has happened. I mean, the Black Death killed 1 in 3 people, and that was, I mean, people thought the world was ending.
And one thing that the book stresses in talking about, you know, how small the world is, and so much talk about the airplanes and the guy has the airplane tattoo, you know, is that these people are just kind of planet hopping. And if you have a virus or disease that spreads so quickly, you know, it was everywhere but Antarctica. There's almost no preparedness really that you can have for something like that.
Well, that we can have. Part of me thinks that, you know, the CDC and the governments have contingency plans for all this.
No, you like to think so, right? Like, that's the...
I mean, I don't know that they'll work. I'm not saying they'll work or that they'll be good. I'm just saying that they probably have some idea of, like, what procedure would be, maybe. I don't know.
There isn't much humor in the book, but one funny passage I thought was when Kristen is talking to, I think it's August, when they're trying to get back to the Traveling Symphony, and he says, do you believe in ghosts? And she goes, I don't know, maybe. She goes, of course I don't. Imagine how many there'd be, because everybody's dead. So I thought that was the one moment of levity in the book.
Oh, yeah. See, I didn't think that was funny at all. I was like, oh, that's so terrible.
Oh, no, they weren't saying it to be funny. I chuckled.
Right.
It was like, yeah, that's the closest thing we get to being funny. True. But yeah, if there's ghosts, then there'd be 5 billion extra ghosts hanging out.
I think there's room for this book to be funnier. That is another criticism.
Yeah.
You know, there's room for that, but it just...
It does take itself very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of going back to what Alex said about the dialogue feeling a little flat. And that, I think that's part of it. The characters didn't feel as rounded as I thought they could be. Though there was some really good stuff in there in terms of, like was previously mentioned, just showing, like, these very human elements, for sure. That was a thing.
All right. On that note, I think we're good to go. Thank you, everyone, for joining and for listening. And be sure to vote for the next book club. We'll have it up in a couple days, probably. Thanks, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers.
Take care.
God, that sound. I can't.
You should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
There's all these firsthand accounts of, you know, just, you know, having orgies in churches because they thought, like, oh, this is our last time to have fun. And just all these awful, you know, petty kings rose up and, like, they thought it was the end of the world. And not that I want to have orgies in churches, but, you know, this kind of stuff has happened over the years. And people, I know, churches.
Delayed reaction.
It's uncomfortable.
You guys don't all do that now? What? I don't know.
I guess we're in the after show then.
Yeah, I think the thing there is that people want to think that our infrastructure would keep us safe from that, but I mean you know, the Ebola thing is like an example of, like, people are not ready. If something was really bad and really contagious to the degree of this, we would not be prepared for it. We wouldn't be able to deal with it. So that is true, and it's a little bit more realistic and scary. To even get this in the book, like they say, like the zombies, they're like, oh, it could be worse, but that is way less likely than this. Yeah.
Well, that's what confuses me about, like, zombie apocalypses, that, like, that it is so rapidly spread, because, I mean, the reason why Ebola doesn't spread in places with proper containment as much is because it's currently transmissible, you know, only through fluid. Like, you know, airborne is a completely different, you know, that's why everybody gets colds. Like, it's a completely different, like, category of worry and terrifyingness, you know. I forget why I was saying that. Why was I saying that?
For me, it's like we think that we would be safe, like, in the circumstance, but it totally is, like, a thing that could happen. Like, we're not any better off than the Black Death, I think. Well, maybe we are, but...
God, that sound! I can't.
We should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
There we go. Now we're in the after show. I just like to have
this. Right. I thought we were in, like, you know, the Black Death and...
We probably were. I'll cut a lot of that out.
Where we have our orgies.
Yeah.
Preferred orgy location of choice.
You would have an orgy in churches. It's all hard benches. I mean, really.
This is true. I mean, I guess there's a lot of traction, but...
Now we're getting down to it. It's all about positioning.
God, that sound!
We should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
Are you guys, is anybody here survivalists? I was talking to Texas on the forums about, like, how this book made me want to, you know, stash this because... Shane! Yes, Shane!
You knew who it was.
Does that mean I'm Long Island?
No, this is not your name. You're the fool.
You're the fool, yeah.
I'm the boulder.
Well, anyway, I was like, you know, this book makes me want to store 60 gallons of water in my basement. And he's like a crazy person. And he's like, well, how do you think I am? I have 50 gallons of water.
I love that scene because it definitely...
And I don't know if he's kidding or not, but, like, I'm not joking. I actually want to do it. Like, I feel like eventually if I, like, you know, ever have kids and whatever, I will probably be that person.
Yeah, even if I don't think that Jeevan fits so well into the latter half of the narrative, I do love that first scene of him being just, because I think it captures the anxiety of that feeling of nothing being safe, and you know, the sort of, like, I don't know, like, hypochondriac, like, extreme fear of everything and wanting to do whatever he can to isolate himself. I thought it was a very effective way of demonstrating that feeling.
Yeah, and I went through a phase when everybody was at, like, the Y2K craze in 1999, and I mean, I was in ninth grade, but I used to, like, take my allowance and, like, buy cans of food and put them in the basement. And I've talked about it before, but how I was like, actually depressed that it didn't happen, because I was so looking forward to not having to go back to high school. And I got used to it, but yeah, I really... Because those are the first books I really read, was, like, you know, those, and those movies I was obsessed with. But I would love it, but at the same time, I would die. I would not make it.
Yeah, the thing is, I have no useful skills at all, so...
Oh, yeah, I'd be super dead, but I still, you know, like, imagine, like, what it'd be like, even though I have no chance.
You know what gave me that idea also of, like, being that crazy prepared person? Like, I mean, other than the fact that, like, I know some Holocaust survivors who, like... do that as well, you know, storing things. But also in the road, there was that scene where they find that, like, underground safe house, basically, of the people who had prepared perfectly for the apocalypse and died before they could get there. Yeah. And I was, like, just thinking, like, oh my God, those people are crazy and brilliant, you know. And then, yeah, from then on, I'm like, sometimes I'm really like, okay, what do we have in the house?
Right, but even the more you prepare, it's only a temporary measure. Like, Jeevan had 60 gallons of water, and it got him through, you know, a couple weeks. But at one point, it's going to run out, and you have to you need a long-term plan. And unless, I mean, I know there are people out there who do have, you know, like bunkers filled with, you know, and that is more of a long-term plan, but even that, that's got an end date, you know.
Yeah, you have to set up the sort of, in this context, you have to have that, like, that actual, like, renewal of resources, like the farming and the, you know, the hunting and actually being out there and not just hiding in a hole.
And I suppose that's one reason for, you know, being forced to leave is, you know, I could have, you know, me personally, once I run out of food, I don't know how to hunt nothing. You know, I feel like I could have all the people that I'm closest to in the world and we could be in a bunker somewhere, but none of us probably knows how to, you know, purify water or desalinate water or any of those things.
Put drips of the black substance that if you have, I think that's all you have to do. That's my thought process.
Drink it through a t-shirt, it'll be fine.
Yes.
You're dead. Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite, I don't know if anyone else has read the Change series by S.M. Sterling, but the first one is Dies the Fire, and it's set like technology just stops working, we're thrown back into a dark age, and this one guy like raises himself up as like this, you know, the Lord Protector of Portland. It's set in Oregon. He divides society up into useful and unuseful people. And like, if you know how to fix a car, if you were a mechanic, if you were a woodworker, then you're going to get a position, and everyone else just became slaves. And they're like talking like, what did you do? It's like, I was an analyst at an insurance firm. It's like, oh yeah, what did you do? You know, like those kind of, they don't have substance and it's not going to help you in this world. And it scares the crap out of me. Like, who's going to need a bookseller? And I'll be the roving guy with a pack of books selling books from town to town.
Well, yeah, you could be like the librarian guy. That's maybe you wouldn't.
Yeah, but I got to survive. I got to survive to get to that point.
But that's still, I mean,
protect me.
It's still a valuable thing.
No, absolutely. I know. And that's that they talk about here, where the books, you know, Shakespeare and Station 11 are the two texts that survive. And, you know, they survive for different reasons, but they mention a couple times how, you know, Shakespeare in his time, the plague was ever present in that society, and every couple of years, 60,000-70,000 people would just die, you know, and it was just a way of life, and people have been living with this kind of stuff for generations. It's only with medicine in the modern times that it's kind of been, you know, squashed, but, you know, even 100 years ago, we had Spanish flu, which killed, what, 8-10 million people, and that's not that long ago, and Ebola today, you know, it's very timely.
God, that sound!
We should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
But then again, the Ebola thing has been such a shit show that, like,
we're all gonna die, guys. That's how we'll.
I will miss you guys so much and be so concerned about you. No, I seriously think about that sometimes. I'm like, I've made so many friends online. Like, if the internet dropped out, I would really miss people. You know.
Mm-hmm. I think of that, like, I live 2 hours away from, like, my family, and I think, like, if it ends, like, do I have to try to get back to them, or can I just, like, go on with my life and start a new life, you know? I know it sounds kind of cruel, but, like, I think of it as, like, am I going to be that guy who's going to, like, have to journey to get back and, you know, I don't know.
Do you have an answer?
Of course I would try, but
just I would like it. By the way. Like, just FYI, I won't be coming.
Yeah, you guys come over here in case of a zombie apocalypse.
I hope that didn't make me sound too cruel. I'm a realist. You know, you have to, you know, I've got plans. No,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, you gotta be ready.
God, that sound. I can't.
You should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
I know everybody wants to do Perdido Street Station, so I feel like that might win this time, but there's always new books coming out, so we'll see.
I want to do the Bone Clocks. Was that the runner-up for this one, or
it got a couple votes? Yeah, it's cool. A long book. Like, I mean, I'd love to talk about. I would like to do the Bone Clocks too, but it's a big one. I'm afraid of.
Well, we'll just bring the vote then. I mean, we're both curators. We can do that.
Why do you think I've put my choices won the first three?
Yeah, you're really on this, Greg. I actually think. Well, I think. Wait, did you get that? You didn't do Half a King. You didn't suggest that, did you?
No, I voted for it because everyone else seemed to be voting for it. But I went along with that one.
That sound. I can't.
You should put that sound in the Museum of Civilization.
All right, so we're all good to go.
Good to go.
Yep. Good.
All right, so what order should we go in today? I want to get it straightened out here. How about Yeah, we'll just go alphabetical. So we'll
by forum names.
Just do your real name.
Last place.
Sorry, Zach. Well, actually, I'll go last. So, well, yeah, I'll go first. Yeah, no, I'll do the intro just so you know. Just so when I go, and would you like to introduce yourselves? Everybody doesn't go wait, whoop, and talk at the same time.
Wait, Lucky Charms, what is your name?
Alex.
Alex, hi.
you beat Amber by 1 second
yeah.
letter.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. I hate going first.
You love it.
No, I hate it.
Okay.